We interrupt this podcast to bring you a special announcement from our sponsor, the Microsoft Micro ISV Evangelism Team. Hello, this is Michael Lehman. I just wanted to let you know that the Project GlidePath Windows Vista Spotlight is now open for business on the projectglidepath.net website. If you're a Micro ISV and you have an application that installs, runs, and uninstalls cleanly on Windows Vista, be sure to register your application at projectglidepath.net. And if your application is one of the first 30 that's registered and passes our test, we'll send you a free Zune. We now return to our regularly scheduled podcast. Hello, and welcome to the Micro ISV show here on Channel 9. I'm your host, Michael Lehman, technical evangelist for the Microsoft Corporation, specializing in Micro ISVs. Today on the Micro ISV show, we're starting a whole new format. And the beginning of this new format is I'd like to announce that I'm now going to have a co-host. My co-host will be Bob Walsh, Managing Director of Safari Software and author of the book Micro ISV from Vision to Reality. Bob, would you like to give our listeners maybe a one-minute introduction to who you are?
Sure. I'm a Micro ISV running a company called Safari Software, Inc. And I basically do two things. I write, and that can be in the form of books and blogs, and I write code in the form of applications. I've done about 20-odd years of contract programming, but my main focus now is my Micro ISV. It has one product out right now called Massless Professional. On the Ryan side of things, you'll find me at three different blogs. MyMicroISV.com is the first one. It's a blog and resource for Micro ISVs, with lots of good guest posts from people who actually know what they're talking about. My second blog is todoorelse.com, all one word. And that's where I get into things like David Allen's Getting Things Done and Online Productivity. And finally, I've just started a new blog called clearblogging.com. And I have a book out in a couple of weeks from A-Press by the same title. And that's a book about everything you need to know to successfully start blogging or to improve the blog that you've got right now. And I'm hoping that with this show and with working with Michael, we can get to some of the people out there who really have useful information for micro ISVs, be they micro ISVs, be they huge vendors, be they people in any name, way, shape, or form out there. So we're going to be expanding the focus of this show, not just interviewing micro ISVs, but interviewing people from all sorts of companies, all sorts of walks of life, who can provide information and experience and wisdom, stuff you can't get out of a book or out of a technical post for micro ISVs. My hope is that we can come across enough information in this podcast to really make your micro ISV succeed.
Perfect. And then without further ado, I'd like to welcome Joel Spolsky to the program. And Bob, take it away.
If you've been programming under a rock for the last few years and you don't know who Joel Spolsky is, Joel Spolsky is the driving force behind Fog Creek Software, which is known for several products, especially Fog Bugs, excellent bug tracking and feature tracking online application, as well as Joel on Software, which is one of the most read developer blogs, I think, out there in the world. Joel, how many people now read Joel on Software in a month?
Oh, at least 50. Well, maybe a little bit more than that. I don't really know. I stopped counting.
Okay, well, the last numbers I heard were pretty significant, something on, what, the order of 400,000 or 500,000 unique visitors a month?
Well, it's probably more than that. Just the job section, that's the only place where I track it, because that's the place where we charge for advertising to list jobs. And the job section is over 700,000 unique visitors per 21 days. That's how long an ad runs for, so probably a little bit more than that per month, and that's really only a section of Joel on Software. So I don't think I would be exaggerating to say that there's at least 1 million a month.
Okay. So Joel's been talking to the developer community for a long, long time. Joel started out with his partner, Michael, I always get his last name spelled wrong.
Pryor. Michael Pryor.
Michael Pryor. And they were at that point what we call today a micro ISV, but obviously Joel's and Fog Creek Software have graduated to bigger and better. How many employees now at Fog Creek?
About a dozen. We usually have big, large numbers of interns. We have some more interns coming back this summer. We'll probably hit about 24, all told, in June. So not quite micro, but still mini.
Okay. One of the things that some of those interns did a couple of years ago was Copilot. Mm-hmm. Maybe the best thing to do is, can you tell me a little bit about what Copilot is and who is it for?
Sure. Well, it started out, I guess I'll tell it through telling a story, which is that when we, our main product is Fogbox, and Fogbox is products that our clients install on the server, and everybody's server is a little bit different, and so even though we have a pretty good setup, we wind up having to diagnose their problems quite a bit, and we found that it's much, much easier when you can use some kind of remote desktop kind of application, similar to the remote desktop that comes with Windows or VNC. The trouble is, 99.9% of the time, both parties, both the helper and the helped party, are behind some kind of firewall. And so a regular traditional VNC-type program won't work. And so we had all kinds of things that we kept trying to do. We had a server that sat outside the firewall on our side where we tried to get our customers hooked in through that. And what we found is just getting our customers to install and run VNC, even with a fairly technical customer who actually knew what VNC was and how it worked, would take about 15 minutes on the phone. And this was rather frustrating, and so we didn't bother doing it. And then it occurred to us, gosh, we could have a little script that just installed VNC for them and set it up and open the appropriate holes in the firewall and the various things. And we had some summer interns coming down the pipeline, so I thought, hey, let's take one of those interns and we'll have them write this little script, and then we'll be able to do our remote desktop support that much easier. And somehow that sort of expanded into, let's take all the interns and let's make a, you know, from scratch program, a custom version of VNC. Fortunately, it's open source, so this is possible as long as you return the, as long as whatever changes you make go back into the product. So that's what they did. It became a standalone executable that configures itself completely and that doesn't require a setup step, so it doesn't leave files around on either the helper or the helped person's computer. And we just did about everything we could think of to make it really, really, really simple to use. And our initial target market, the truth is the target market was people like us, other software companies, trying to help their customers with their products with a remote desktop type situation that would be very secure, all SSL secured and so forth, 128 bits, and not leave anything around on any computers that could later be used as a hacking target or something like that. And also very, very simple, very, very easy to use. So basically the instructions are go to copilot.com and type in this 12-digit number, download and run the program that you find there, and that's it. So the 12-digit number is probably the hardest part of that, and we're working on mental telepathy.
That number. Well, you mentioned in your post when you announced Copilot 2.0 that one of the reasons that you're able to accomplish so much with those interns was that you used open source software as a starting point. Mm-hmm. I want to know that a little further. So really, your product or as a total is sort of a hybrid. Part of it is open source.
Yeah.
That's what's on the desktop. And part of it is proprietary, the back-end server code. What do you think of that as a model for micro ISVs?
Well, the model is really not so much some open source software and some not open source software. It's not the fact that we have that software on the server, because it doesn't do very much. It handles billing and it does what we call, it's what we call a reflector, which means that in order to get through the firewalls, we have to have both parties that need to communicate connect outwards. And so where they connect outwards to is our server, and our server basically just passes traffic between them once they both get connected. And so that is a very, very trivial thing that the first intern wrote in the first 2 days. And then there's some back-end billing and subscription services. And then basically what we feel like we're charging for is the support and the fact that it just works and it's all set up and you don't have to do anything to get it working. Not really the software component. And so there's an awful lot of open source models that are built on the what we're charging for is service and not necessarily the bits. And that's pretty much our model as well, for Copilot at least.
Does that leave Copilot vulnerable to, let's say, some big company walk in, taking the GPL code that you've got out there and just saying, well, we're bigger and better and we have it out there today?
Yeah. Yep. Sure.
Okay.
So please don't. But they could have done that before we created this product, and they didn't. And actually, I'm not that. There's sort of a few issues here. One is it doesn't really worry me that much. I believe that there's a lot more to a brand that around service support and just awareness than the actual do you have the bits that cause this thing to work. And the reason I learned that is over the years, when we first released FogBugs bug tracking software in about 2000, a bunch of clones started springing up. Now, I should say about FogBugs that we do distribute the source code for our customers' convenience, but they're not really allowed to resell it. It's not open source in that sense of the word. For their convenience, they're allowed to look at the source code, modify it for in-house use. But,
right.
But we don't. They're certainly not allowed to sell it. But over the years, at this point, probably 7 or 8 FogBugs clones have popped up all over the world, and none of them has significant sales. So we feel like they're kind of, we look at them and sort of giggle that they're cloning the wrong thing. They've cloned the FogBugs application itself, but they haven't cloned any of our knowledge of how bug tracking works, how the software development process works. They haven't got a website that has a million unique visitors per month. They don't have any of that kind of stuff. So realistically, we're just not that worried about people cloning the actual software. And so there are, I mean, you can, if you want to, you're welcome to go to the Copilot website. You go to the FAQ page, you can download all the source code, and you can build out a service just like Copilot yourself, and it'll take you a few weeks, and then you're going to have to get people to find out about it, and then you're going to have to provide them with a high level of support. And by the time you've done all that, you realize that you're not making quite as much money as we are, and you're also not probably not breaking even on it.
Or you, as you may have hoped if you ripped off somebody's code. You know, I kind of wonder here if the lesson you'd pass on to micro ISVs is not to be as paranoid and upset if their applications get cracked or if people copy their code, and they need to focus on the non-code parts of what they're doing.
Yeah. I mean, when I was, I don't know what the ratio is right now of software developers to not software developers at a company like Microsoft. In the years that I worked at Microsoft, many, many years ago, I believe that it was about 10 to 1 non-coders to coders. Maybe it was 5 to 1. 5 to 1, let's say. But that number is only going to increase. And so when you think about it, a functioning software company, probably 80% of their effort and maybe 80% of their spending is devoted to things other than creating the code, the bits that run on people's computers. And that's sort of really important to keep in mind, that this is not the be-all and end-all. Everything else is actually a little bit more important.
Well, it sounds like, I mean, to get to the real point there, is that for a micro ISV, which is, you know, 1 to 5 people, self-funded effort, the majority of their effort, the majority of their time, ought to be spent on things other than the code base.
Probably about half of it, yeah, at least. In the startup phases, you have to, somebody has to be figuring out where the customers are going to come from, and how to get the customers, because otherwise it's just not going to work. I mean, writing code in a garage and doing nothing else, the code will never, you know, nobody will ever find out about the code. Unless, of course, you invent the code that cures cancer, and that would be great, and people then probably will beat a path to your doorway. But that happens about, 2 out of 3 times. Even 2 or 3 times, in the history of software, Google maybe. But, you know, even in the early days of Google, I'm sure that they were out there pounding the pavement trying to get people to find out about their product and try it out. So it's really, yeah, it's the marketing, it's the awareness, and then it's the support for your customers that makes them elated and makes them tell other people about the product. And all of those things are sort of a really, really crucial component. And the software, not so much.
Okay. Well, let me ask you. I mean, first there was CityDesk, which was a PB6 application for design and templating websites. And if I understand correctly, what happened is fog bugs grew out of your in-house efforts to support that product.
Well, actually, no. CityDesk was second. But there was... Here's the history. The history is that there was a vision. The original vision for the software at Fog Creek was a complete content management system that would have a client component, a server component, and a workflow component. So the workflow component was going to be Fogbugs, basically this way of telling people that they need to work on something in the content management system or that there's a bug on such and such a page that needs to be fixed, and all of the workflow engine you might imagine around, say, journalists working on putting together a website together. The client component was CityDesk, and that was like it was going to be Windows-based because the idea was that people knew how to use word processors, and that provided, theoretically, a vastly superior and richer user interface than a big old edit box on a web page. Mm-hmm. Turns out not to be true. And the server component never shipped, and it never became a product. And what really happened is that Fogbugs shipped first because we had it first, and it actually grew and was very, very popular. And interestingly, the people who read Joel on Software are the most likely people to need or use or want bug tracking, project management, and all the things that Fogbugs does well. And so that kind of became a hit on the strength of the fact that there was an audience that we had, both as Fog Creek and Joel on Software. We had this audience of people that would theoretically be interested in Fogbugs, but that audience wasn't that interested in content management. And content management, for various reasons I have discovered, is not actually a product category. So that sort of failed, and CityDesk is now, I would say, highly de-emphasized. We're not really developing it anymore. We're continuing to support it because we're fanatical about support, and it runs fine on Vista. But we're not really going to continue developing that because it's just too small a market compared to our other products.
Well, is this a statement more about how things have worked out for Fog Creek, or is it a statement that you're really weighing in on the desktop versus the web app argument here?
I'm willing to weigh in on the desktop versus web app argument here. I don't think there's pretty much anything left that needs to be a desktop app, unless you need to interface with hardware that you don't have access to through the web. And even then, most people will build sort of web applications that talk to a very small proprietary component.
The New York Post headline for this, Joel says, desktop's dead?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I very much changed my opinion just because we saw that people weren't that interested in the city. I mean, some people were, and there's definitely a community of people that love the CityDesk idea of desktop-based content management. But and we kept saying nobody wants to edit in a big old text box and use that as a day-to-day editor. It's so awful compared to Microsoft Word or compared to the rich GUI desktop experience. And then we saw that most people are perfectly happy to use web-based email. Really, almost everyone is completely happy using web-based email as their primary email interface. Even people who have, Exchange Server and Outlook available to them are, more than happy to use Gmail and often prefer it. So, it has finally gotten into my head, I think, that all the things that I consider to be superior parts of the desktop experience are just not that important to the mass audience.
Hmm. I'd probably disagree with you, but I have to say that you've got a lot more experience with this than I do.
Yeah, well, I've been wrong once before. I'm happy to be wrong again. I'll probably flip-flop on this particular issue a couple more times. But right now, I really can't see building anything other than as a web-based app. And look at CityDesk, for example. It's all sort of driven through the web, but there does have to be a Windows-based component to it, or a desktop-based component, because we have Mac and Windows now. Similarly, Skype needs something on the client. But I'm pretty sure, actually, that if you look at Skype, and I don't quite know how it's architected, but I'm pretty sure that there's sort of HTML as a pretty significant component of the technology that they use to build their desktop app. So even if you're building a desktop app, or look at QuickBooks, the quintessential desktop app, large swaths of that now are implemented in the form of HTML that's hosted by IE inside QuickBooks.
So maybe this really is not the argument anymore about having a desktop app that doesn't communicate to the internet. It's that any application has got to be internet connected and internet centric.
Almost any except for very specific vertical needs, that's true. And the way you can see that is think about word processing and how much of your word processing you do in your email program, whatever that may be. How much of that do you do in your blogging program, whatever that may be? And how rare is it that you actually have to bust out Word for Windows and actually, type a letter because you need to print something to send to the, local division of jurors to try to get out of jury duty or something.
Okay.
That doesn't have email yet.
Well, of course, the interesting thing to that particular discussion is that when most people use web-based things, the underlying technology in the browser is still actually using either the rich text box function of the that's built into the OS or the runtime library, or they're actually sometimes even using Microsoft Word components under the hood without actually busting out Word as a separate application. And I think more and more, just to add my two cents into this discussion, that all of these things are indeed becoming like hosting containers. Part of my evangelism program has released a thing called Project GlidePath, and as part of that, not only are there inside Visual Studio, not only there are custom dialog boxes, but there are a variety of web browser components used in critical places, both for local content as well as content on the web. So it's becoming more and more blurred. But as you said, we could have the discussion about whether the desktop is dead or not, long into the night. But yeah. It's interesting to hear your opinion on that.
It's a little bit premature to say that it's quite dead. What I would say, however, is that if anybody came up to me and said they were going to build an application of some particular sort, and I couldn't really see any need for it to do anything, maybe, let's say, hardware-specific or performance-specific that really needed to be a desktop application, I don't see any reason it shouldn't be built as a web application at this point. Something like, let's say that you were going to build QuickBooks today, you would definitely build that as a web application. It's there's no question that the benefits that you get for having it be a web application greatly outweigh the slightly reduced quality of the user interface that you can build, which is increasingly less and less true thanks to AJAX and so on and so forth. It's not even true anymore that you can't build it.
Yeah, but I think it's going to be a long, long way down the road before we see Photoshop as a web service.
But don't forget that Photoshop, maybe. Then again, what 80% of people do with pictures is going to be scaling and rotating and fixing colors and stuff like that. And applications like Flickr that can actually, or Picasa that can actually do really, really neat things with those photos. I guess Picasa is a desktop app, huh? applications that it's not so interesting to say, like, what are you doing in Photoshop? What's more interesting is, like, how are you getting your digital pictures out and distributing them to your friends? And there may be a couple of short editing stages between the camera and putting it up on the web, and those are the kinds of things that can be done easily with web applications and probably relatively elegantly. A full application for a designer who sits there all day long manipulating digital images, I'm sure Photoshop still has a space on the desktop.
When you look at the most successful web applications, a big component of that success is the online communities that have sprung up around them. Matter of fact, some of these applications are nothing but the community. Mm-hmm. So I guess the question I'd ask you is, if you were going to start out from tomorrow as a micro ISV,
mm-hmm.
Pick whatever, you can pick the proverbial graphics photography application you've talked about how much time and effort would you put into building the community versus just building the code base?
That's a good question. The community may be Well, the community will create itself as long as you get the parameters right, and as long as you've done the right things so as not to drive people away, the community will probably build itself if it's a, you know, if the chemistry is created correctly. So there it's just a matter of sort of fine-tuning it and hitting it off. And you may, the answer to that question sort of depends on how you plan to market your product. A community is often used as a way to distribute and market a product. Take Flickr, for example, where the community features were pretty much crucial to ensure that there would be a reason for people to tell other people about Flickr and thus market it in that way. In our case, in the case of, for example, Fogbugs, you know, we sort of have a bit of more of a broadcast thing with Joel on software than a community thing. Although there are discussion forums, that's probably they probably only get 5% of the people that ever pass through Joel on software will stop by the discussion forums and the community features. Mostly it's just kind of a broadcast media kind of thing. And that's okay too. So the real question is, how are people going to find out about your product and tell other people about your product? And a community is one way of building that into your product itself, making your product what we used to call viral, giving it some reason for people to tell other people about it. There are ways of doing that without necessarily building it into your product. If your product is remarkable in the Seth Godin sense, remarkable meaning it's the kind of thing you might want to remark about because it's interesting in some particular way, then people will talk about it even if it doesn't have its own community mechanism built in. And if you already have a platform or gigantic marketing infrastructure, like let's say you're Microsoft, then it's a lot less important to try to build communities.
Okay. Well, let me ask you a favorite question of mine, which is, should micro ISVs blog? And if so, when and why?
That's a good question. I used to sort of say, there's no question that the fact that I blog through Joel on Software, I used to deny that it was a blog. It's sort of not really a blog. It's more of a place where I write
Of a photo blog. It came before blogging.
There's no question that through that I have managed to build up an audience who also then hear about Fogbugs and Copilot and buy those products, or at least they check them out. And really my entire goal with Joel on Software was an educational one. Is there's certain things that I've learned about software development, and I wanted to spread the word because, you know, just even from the most selfish perspective, so that I never again have to take a job at a company that doesn't know how to do these things right. But more importantly, and the Joel on Software definitely predated Fog Creek, and I was writing those articles long before Fogbugs or Copilot or anything. So there is sort of a skeptical view that I'm just doing this in order to sell the products, and that can be fairly trivially disproven by the fact that I was doing Joel on Software before I was trying to sell products. And, you know, one of the books came out, UI for Programmers actually predated our selling any products. To answer your question, though, should people blog? It sort of depends. It's been very successful for me, and it's been very successful for other companies I can think of, like 37 Signals. On the other hand, I've seen an awful lot of blogs that come across as either tone deaf or not authentic. A good example might be Jonathan Schwartz, where there's a strong feeling that everything's being censored by a PR department very heavily, and everything is a little bit too Marcom happy smiley. It doesn't really sound like something that Jonathan Schwartz would necessarily say. And those are probably not very helpful. There are also people, you know, if you're a micro ISV and you're just sort of a really good developer and you craft beautiful software, you may not be such a good writer, and blogging may be a waste of time if you're not really going to get a readership. I mean, you should probably have a blog at least to keep people up to date on what you're doing. But, you know, if you're not going to really have something important to say that people want to read, independent of what you're working on, and write it well, then you're not all that likely to build up a large enough audience that that's going to be a good marketing mechanism for you.
Okay. Michael, any last questions?
Yeah, Joel, I would say that as part of, you know, what we are trying to do with the Micro ISV show to help Micro ISVs figure out what it is they need to be doing to be successful, I liked your comment about that they need to be spending, you know, 50% or perhaps even more of their time, at least post-development cycle, thinking about their business. What if you could pick one tip based on your experience of going from, you know, zero to hero, what would be the thing you would tell yourself from 5 years ago, if you could give yourself a piece of advice now to be the one thing not to miss, what the one thing you should do.
Can I have two things?
You can have two things.
Okay. The number one thing is that micro-ISV shouldn't be one person. It should be two people at the very least. And one of them should have sort of the business and the marketing and the sales skills experience, and the other one should have the technical skills and the programming and the inventing the product kind of skills. And that kind of partnership is far more likely to be successful than the individual working alone, just because people don't usually have both of those skill sets. And so, and they really need to all be covered. If you have only the sales and marketing, you're not going to be successful because you won't have a good product. And if you have only the product development skills, you're not going to be successful because nobody will hear about you, and the business side won't really work. And so those are, and having two people, I feel, is crucial just to validate your idea and almost to keep each other motivated, bounce ideas off of each other, and so on. So that's sort of the first part, is the minimum size for a micro ISV that's going to go anywhere beyond a fun project, I think, is two. The second part, Bob alluded to this earlier, which is my prototypical example of the photo gallery, which is that probably 9 million micro ISVs have made an application where it's like, hey, everybody's got these digital cameras. My application lets you upload all your pictures and put them on the web and make web galleries. And there have been about 1 million of these, and a very tiny number of them have been successful, and the vast majority of them have been sort of instant flops. And for some reason, this is an incredibly appealing idea for software developers to do. Maybe it's because they feel like they know how to do everything. They know all the steps that they're going to need to do to write the code to make this work. But for some reason, they never really make it work. But what I've always told these people time and time again, and they never listen to me, is instead of making the generic upload your pictures application, pick a very, very small niche audience, wedding photographers, and make the ultimate application for wedding photographers. Find out exactly what wedding photographers need. There's a lot of money around wedding photography. They get paid an awful lot of money. Figure out exactly what their workflow is, and it's easy to find wedding photographers because they're in the yellow pages, and they're directories of these things, and you can call them all and find out what they want and try to sell them your solution. And so what I always tell micro ISVs is, and that's just an illustrative picture, try to narrow your potential audience almost as much as possible to get started. You're going to have to find, in order to bootstrap, you're going to have to find a very small initial audience that you can serve extremely well, of people who all speak to each other, who you can find all in one place, where there's money being spent because you're going to need to get a part of it for this thing to work. And once you find that very, very narrow niche, that's the way you get bootstrapped, and then you can think about crossing the chasm, as Jeffrey Moore says, into other kinds of industries and other kinds of, other larger markets. But you really need to pick something vertical to start with.
Okay. I think that's going to do it for today's show.
Great.
All right. Joel, thank you very much for coming on the MicroISV show.
Sure,
and if people want to go and find out more about you and your products and so forth, what's the best web address for them to go to?
Tell them to go to joelonsoftware.com. That's my personal webpage, and there's links to all kinds of groovy stuff down the side. If it's their first time at Joel on Software, you can start with a little sidebar and just read through that, and you'll get links to all the kind of past stuff, and we'll bring you up to date. And the main section of Joel on Software is things that I post about once a week.
All right. Sounds great. All right. Thank you very much to Joel Spolsky for coming on the MicroISV show today. As always, the views expressed by our guests are not necessarily those of the Microsoft Corporation or the hosts, but they are respected views of our respected guests, and we enjoy bringing them to you. Bob, do you have any closing words?
One thing to add, Michael, is that if the people out there listening to this podcast know of someone that we should interview, please contact me or Michael at our respective emails, and let us know. We really are looking for people out there to interview that can bring value to the micro ISV community.
All right. And thank you, Bob, for joining the show as a co-host. I think this was a great opening for our new venture, and I'm looking forward to future shows. And as always, check back here next week for the next edition of the Micro ISV show here on channel9.msdn.com.